That's my dad, Victor Gowan, playing a piece called Adieu to the Piano. My dad passed away in 2004, but a few years before that, when he was in his early 90s, I recorded him sitting at his Chickering baby grand, quote-unquote, tinkling the ivories, as he did every evening for much of his life. Music was his hobby, not his profession, but he dedicated much of his spare time to studying it and perfecting his favorite compositions. My dad's love of the piano was infectious, and he encouraged me to take lessons, and I'm really glad he did. Today, there are few sounds I like better than solo acoustic piano. The piano is a majestic and elegant instrument and can evoke so much emotion, whether played in a style that's smooth and romantic or one that's percussive and emphatic. But as you'll learn in this interview, as much as people may love the sound of this instrument, not everyone values them in the same way. In fact, many pianos sit abandoned for years, eventually destined for the dump, unwanted, unplayed, and unsung. But why? That's one of the things I'll be asking today's guest, Kelly Crowe. Kelly is a journalist, multimedia artist, collector, and music enthusiast. She's been a friend of mine for several years now, and I've come to know her as someone who always has a new idea or another fascinating project on the go. I don't know how she keeps up with herself, but she does. To be in her company is to be constantly intrigued and amazed. Kelly's latest endeavor is entitled The Possession Project. It's an audio documentary series about our human impulse to accumulate stuff and what we do with that stuff. Episode 1 of The Possession Project is called The Day the Music Died at the Dump, and it investigates the complex fate of the unwanted piano. Kelly is a true music lover, and although she's not a professional musician per se, she loves to play both piano and guitar. However, she rarely plays for other people or in public. Until today. She was kind and brave enough to record a sample of her piano improvisation for inclusion in this episode. So, you'll be treated to that at the end of the show. Stick around. Thanks so much to Kelly and her partner Paul Hamill for allowing me to record this episode at their lovely home. It was there a couple of years ago, just before Omicron hit, that my music buddy partner in crime, Tim Vesley, and I performed our first ever house concert as an acoustic duo. It was a lot of fun, so hopefully we'll do that again someday. And if we do, I'll keep you posted. Thank you for tuning in to our 30th episode. If you enjoy the pod, please share, comment, and rate on social media or on your podcast platform. You can get in touch via email. I'm jane@musicbuddy.ca, and I'd love to hear from you. Or you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at Music Buddy Podcast. And then on TikTok, we're at Music Buddy Pod. Music Buddy is 100% listener supported. In order to keep the show up and running and remain ad-free, we rely on your kind donations. If you're in a position to help us out, please go to musicbuddy.ca/donate or look for the button on our Instagram. Now, let's get into the good stuff. Here's my conversation with my friend, Kelly Crowe.
It's all feeling, it's all love. It's all connection, that human stuff. So tell me where you're coming.
Kelly Crowe, welcome.
Thank you.
To Music Buddy. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for providing the venue. We're at your house, a house I love and I've been to several times, but it's really nice to always come here and see you.
Oh,
and,
you are always welcome.
And your man, Paul, is downstairs making some pizzas.
He's making his dinner. Yeah.
Amazing. So I was thinking about when our friendship started. It was born of a mutual love of music, mm-hmm. the Weaker Thans. Mm-hmm. And our friend Tim Faulkner, also a Music Buddy guest, he set us up kind of like to go out together. Do you remember that part of it?
I thought it was David Barber that set us up.
David Barber was there.
Right.
But Tim said to me, you should go out with Kelly and go to the Weaker Thans. And I said, well, are you going to be there? And he said, no, I'm not going to be there. So yeah, it was just you. I think it was you, me, and Dave Barber.
Yeah, yeah. I remember we had a great time. I looked it up, that the date. The
Good
date
for
was
you.
May 26, 2010.
Amazing.
Because you can find anything out.
You're incredible.
On the internet. I just said Toronto, Weaker Thans, Queen Elizabeth Theatre. When were they there? So, yeah, we had a great time.
Yeah, we did. So, and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah, yeah. We hit it off right away.
How about that? Every time I see you, you've got something interesting to talk about, some project on the go, something you're doing. You're very energetic. I mean, you retired, quote unquote, from CBC as a journalist mm-hmm. 2 years?
Three years ago now? Just in the first sort of 3 or 4 months of COVID.
Right. But since then, you've just been doing so many different things. Were you a science and technology reporter? What was your role?
More science and medical science, you know, health.
Health.
Whatever sort of fell into that kind of file.
Yeah.
But I was always interested in science. So
yeah.
I always looked for science stories, even when I was working on just general assignment covering everything. So yeah, I'm a geek.
I probably wouldn't put it that way. You're interested in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So in your retirement, you've started this podcast/essay project called The Possession Project.
Right.
What gave you the idea to start that? I mean, I know you're very into miniature things and you've got a large collection of many different things, but tell me what started this possession project out.
Yeah, well, I wanted to do something. I thought, should I write a book? And I thought, I don't think anybody would read a book that I would write. And I thought, and I was making these little projects, you know, these little various miniature things, which I've only recently sort of given myself permission to talk about because I was afraid people would think I was crazy.
Yeah, well,
they may still.
Well, it took a while before you were willing to show us
those. That's right.
We had to, I think, have a few visits before you let us see your, what do you call them, dioramas?
Yeah, I don't
actually. Your miniature worlds.
If I'm being pretentious, I would call them, a collage, a three-dimensional collage.
Yeah.
You know, sort of multimedia collage thing.
Right.
But the fact is, they're essentially little worlds that I make. Mm-hmm. And I'm not interested in making dollhouses or anything like that. I'm interested in making sort of things that are a little bit weirder. Mm-hmm. So, of course, everybody, when they finish a career, they think, it's time for me to write a book about what my career was really like, what's really going on in the news business.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of doing that, I made one of these pieces that's everything that I wanted to say about the news business.
Oh.
You know, the roles of influence and spin and PR and, you know, the declining industry. And so I got that all out of my system in that piece, and I thought, this is actually, it works, this idea of making these things. But of course, they're not going anywhere. I don't know what to do with them. I'm probably going to put them on the curb at the end of the day. Like, I just, they're right. just sort of, I'm, and so that partly inspired the possession project, because I realized I'm part of this, the world that's making all this stuff that's piling up and choking, you know, the planet. And I'm very much aware and interested and aware of the sort of environmental issues in general, but I'm also quite interested in this idea of consumption and this, the constant acquiring and making and the machinery and the sort of the economic pressure to continue to create stuff in order for the economy to keep on going the way people seem to want it to go, it depends on all of us consuming all this stuff. And then we're extracting it from the earth and we're dumping it in piles. And I'm just really interested in that whole, you know, what that says about us. But at the same time, I have this secret, not so secret, I guess, urge and impulse to collect things. Like, I love stuff. So I'm just as bad. And if, now that I'm making stuff, you know, crazy stuff, I'm adding to the problem. So I thought, well, what is it about possessions? And I love the idea of doing this audio print combination. It's really interesting because now that you can do it all yourself, I mean, I come from, 30 years of broadcasting where we needed a full team to do the work. Now you can really, I literally sit in this room with a microphone and a computer and I can do all the editing and I can do all the, you know, mixing and I just have to go out and interview people. So it was fun to use everything that I used to do professionally in this personal project, and also fun to put it on, also to write an essay, which is independent of the sort of the audio part. So I'm experimenting with these different medium.
Yeah.
The idea of talking about possessions intrigued me. And so I think I just said to a friend, I think I might do that. And I think I might call it the Possession Project. And they sort of nodded at me, you know, sort of the way they do always, like, whatever, whatever you want,
okay,
Kelly.
Okay, crazy, Kelly.
Yeah, so I just started.
You started the Possession Project, and your first episode is called The Day the Music Died at the Dump.
Right.
I went down to the sacred store where I'd heard the music years before, but the man there said the music wouldn't play. And in the streets the children screamed, the lovers cried and the poets dreamed, but not a word was spoken. The church bells all were broken, and the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast. The day the music died.
And it's about pianos and the fact that there are so many pianos that people are giving away. They can't sell them. They just give them away. And then a lot of them end up in the dump. So over to you to expound upon that.
Well, it started when I was going through, you know, online junk sites, basically, you know, looking for stuff because I have this stuff problem. I love, you know, sort of, I guess we call it vintage stuff now, but I just love stuff. So I'm cruising through these things looking, and I keep finding pianos, and I noticed that they were being offered for free. And I went, how can a piano be free? How can a piano have no value? And of course, people say, well, you know, they're too big and, you know, the cost, it's expensive to move them and they need to be tuned. But that didn't satisfy me. I'm going, really, really? And is that our best idea, that you can take something as magnificent as a piano, something that was once very valuable, and just throw it in the dump? That's our best idea. So I couldn't stop thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So I started just doing what I would do as a journalist, sort of researching and looking around, asking people. At the end of it, I still wasn't satisfied. I know the reasons now why they're ending up in the dump, and they are.
Yeah.
But I still don't think that's a good answer.
Right.
A good enough answer.
There's a, I guess you call it a scene from that podcast where you're counting how many are available mm-hmm. online. It was like something like 100 and...
Almost 200. And that was just one day.
Yeah.
And I've done it again since just to check my facts and going, was that just one weird day? And it's Have not. You? It's always like that. You wow. just... I just counted the... how if I was to drive about 3 hours radius from where I live,
yeah.
I could have found 200 pianos free.
Incredible.
And a couple of organs.
Right.
Like I included the organs too.
Organs are even more heavy. But the podcast opens with you meeting the movers at the dump.
Right.
And it's really heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And you recorded them basically just tossing it off the truck
yeah.
into
yeah.
the landfill. So how did that make you feel?
Yeah, it was weird. Like yeah. it was weird. It's already weird going to the dump anyway. But yeah, they simply pushed it off the back of the truck. It made this really shuddering, kind of like, you know, shattering sound. And then it goes flying into the air. And then it made a really disappointing sound when it hit the dump. It's like, boom. I mean, that's it. Oh. Like, I wanted the satisfaction of a huge crash because I thought that would be appropriate for what was happening here. But it leaves a little thump.
Ah.
And then they threw another one. It was another thump. And then I looked at these huge carcasses lying sort of face down in amongst, like, there was some old rolls of carpet and some other stuff. And that's it. It was, it would be extreme to say upsetting in the sense, I mean, there's many, many things in life that are more upsetting than watching a piano going to the dump. But based on the research I was doing, it was like, I felt I had to see it. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky. The movers were very nice about arranging for me. You know, it was a rainy day. I'm going, call me the next time you're throwing out a piano. And that's how I was able to be there. But
right.
yeah, it was, I felt I needed to see it.
Yeah.
And then I met Shane Lyon. I don't know if you
yeah.
heard. He's a expert in dealing with people's stuff. He's in outside of Chicago, right. and he has a YouTube channel where he puts up videos of him helping people get rid of their junk. It's kind of a hobby, part-time thing that he does.
Amazing.
And he started off one of these videos telling people that, I'm warning you, I'm going to be throwing a piano in the garbage. Don't freak out.
Right.
And I thought, so I need to talk.
Trigger warning.
Yeah, I need, exactly. It was exactly a trigger warning.
Wow.
So I thought, I need to talk to Shane about this. And so I got in touch with him. He was great.
Wow.
And he said, yeah, hey, people will freak out if they find out that they're seeing a piano going into the dump, because people, there's an emotional thing that people don't really think about this. I mean, why would they? But mm-hmm. The fact is, pianos, 6,000 pieces, incredible old wood craftsmanship, the fact that it makes music from the simple act of touching a key, mm-hmm. all that goes right into the dump. Mm-hmm. We just don't want them anymore.
And by calling it, earlier you referred to it as a carcass, which
yeah.
I just think is so evocative because it does attach a certain humanity to it. And the fact that pianos have got so much, so many hands have handled them. They haven't
exactly.
displayed them, but building them, there's so much humanity inside of them, right?
Not just humanity, but the earth. I mean, the
yeah.
wood and the copper, the ivory sometimes for the keys.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah, it's an amazing thing.
The band unethical things
yeah.
that were used for them in those old days, right?
Yeah.
Like the ivory and the ebony, both, mm-hmm. you can't use either of those, which is good mm-hmm. now. But the
ebony and the ivory on keys that are on those pianos are going into the dump.
That's right.
I mean, people aren't harvesting those. I mean, I should say no one in the world is. Probably some places are. But the point is, you can't sell ivory. It
yeah.
has no value, because otherwise you're creating a market which will put elephants in jeopardy. So
mm-hmm.
you can't even have it, as far as I mean, you can't cross a border with it. Piano, I heard several stories of people, these piano restorers, trying to move pianos over a border from the U.S. to Canada. They were stopped and they had to call a technician or find somebody that could rip the ivory off the keys at the border. The ivories are seized and then they bring the naked keys back across the border.
Oh,
so
incredible.
So it has no value, but it's hard to reconcile that, you know, this such a high environmental cost for that product, and
right.
yet you can't even use it for anything legally anyway.
Yeah, it's too bad you can't put it back on the elephant. That would be nice. You know, when I was younger and we had our two pianos in our house and they both had ivory keys, and I just thought, oh, nice ivory keys.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember seeing plastic keys and I was kind of horrified. But then you start to learn where these things come from as you grow up, right? And then that's even more horrifying, the fact that, you know, all that was made from elephant tusks.
I was also interested to learn that even back in the 50s, the piano industry was trying to figure out what to do about ivory because it was such a pain in the neck. Because it's so finicky and it stains and cracks. Right. And so, you know, the switch to plastics was also in part motivated by the fact that it's just simpler to deal with.
But speaking of plastics, like, it seems like compared to some things that people keep for a long time, like, I just wrote down a few, like beach balls, overcoats, vintage plastic containers, lamps, etc., right? Yeah. So much of that stuff is made of plastic, but what is it that makes pianos? I mean, you were speaking of their size, you have to tune them, they're expensive to move, you have to have room in your place, but they are less attractive to the majority of people than, say, a Tupperware collection or something like that.
People think they're ugly. I found this out too. I mean, they're hulking pieces of dark furniture in modern spaces. Another big factor is that you can replace a piano with an electronic keyboard that gives you all kinds of different options and it takes up much less space. People are trying to get these things out of their houses, and it's hard to get rid of a piano. It will cost you several hundred dollars just to move it.
Right.
There may be a cost when you dump it in the dump, a fee for that.
Yeah.
You can't leave it on the street. The city won't pick it up. I talk to people who it's an albatross.
Yeah.
In their lives trying to get rid of this piano.
Adios. Adios. Adios to your afternoon. Cause tonight I'll be forever following the Colosseum moon into a certain room. Adios.
But I mean, you think about just how beautiful the sound of a piano is and how it's so easy. You can go and hit, you know, strike the piano and make a beautiful sound. You don't have to know how to play the piano. And you were talking about first episode, you're talking about how you see sometimes pianos out in public and someone will just pick up and be playing it.
If you leave a piano out in the open, someone will play it.
This is Kelly's rule.
It's not my rule. I observe. This is my observation. I've seen it. You know, some places are doing this for fun. I mean, all over France, and I was in France two summers ago, there were pianos in train stations and in the airport, and people would play it. People would line up to play it. And there's a great story that a friend of mine put me in touch with. His name is David Scott Robertson is the person that I was interviewing. And he had this experience where he was moving into a house and someone left behind a piano. The house was empty. All that was left was a piano. But they needed to redo the floors. And they had their own piano coming. So they put the piano on the porch. And, you know, he's upstairs one day and he hears this music and he thinks it's a radio. And then he realizes it's a guy on his porch playing beautiful music. So he went down and he said to the guy, "You can have this piano," and they wheeled it down the street and never saw it again. But it's a great example of the fact that people cannot resist a piano sitting out.
Which is sort of it's reverse of what you think. I mean, people don't want them in their homes, but they're happy to have them out in the open, you know, sort of like, I don't know. You wouldn't want necessarily an eagle in your home, but you're happy to have one out in the open. When you see a piano in a public space, do you go and sit down and play it?
It depends. Yeah. I would want to.
Right.
But I might not. I mean, I wouldn't want to, inflict that on people waiting for a train. I think you have to have a lot of the good part of this experiment of leaving pianos out is that it self-selects for good piano players. Most of the time you have someone playing it is going to know how to play because the rest of us are too afraid. We have this crippling performance anxiety. So in the end, you actually get good music, I think, in a way. I love to play, but I'm a solitary player. I don't play I don't play when anyone can hear me, but I do play a lot.
Yes, and I mean, you have a beautiful piano here.
Yes, yeah. I'm fortunate. My partner, Paul, brought it with him into our relationship. Well, not this very piano.
No.
There's a whole piano story about how we arrived at this one, but it's so wonderful to have a piano in the house. I really am spoiled, and you sit at the piano for a few minutes, and time just... It collapses. You forget about everything. It really does. It's amazing. My piano playing is completely random. I don't play a song. I just mess around. It's right. So pound away, and I haven't had the discipline to learn. I can read music, but I can read music the way I read French, which is takes me forever to get to the M, translating. Okay, this is E. Every good boy deserves fun. Okay, that must be the F. Oh, and then the bass clef. Oh my God, what are those notes? I don't even. It's like a mathematical problem.
And then by that time, a whole hour has passed by.
I know. It's
absorbing.
So I rather just hammer away. So
yeah.
So that's my style.
Did you grow up with one in the house?
I did not.
Uh-huh.
And this is part of the story because right. I pined for a piano. I longed for a piano. I wanted to be the kid that couldn't play outside because they were being forced to practice.
Oh, no.
But we didn't have a piano, and I grew up in a small town. We didn't even have really piano teachers. It was so whenever I got near a keyboard, like a toy piano or some kid's toy, I would start bashing it out. But here's another fundamental truth about pianos. Mm-hmm. You almost never get a chance, if you can't play a piano, to have access to a piano. Because if you go to someone's house and they have a piano, you can't just sit and start playing because it annoys everybody. And you're usually there for a social reason. I can't tell you how hard it was for me to actually get near a piano. I would walk by pianos, in restaurants and go, oh, I'd love to touch that piano. So one day, my sister, who was working in Prague, they were just put up in someone's house, this sort of a furnished place. They had a grand piano in this apartment in Prague, and it had its own room. It was a big, beautiful black grand piano.
Wow.
And I couldn't play it because the baby was sleeping. And I'm like, oh my God.
No.
But my sister and her family had to suddenly come back to Canada for a family event. And I still had a few days in Prague before my flight. So I spent 3 days. I don't think I left the apartment. I didn't know any songs. I only knew, she'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. And I started to see I was euphoric. It sounds silly, doesn't it?
But it's amazing.
And then I came back to Canada after that trip, and I thought, I'm getting myself a. So I just got a little Roland keyboard at that point.
But yeah, that's like that Joni Mitchell song. I'm going to rent me a grand piano, put some flowers around my room. Maybe I'll go to Amsterdam. Maybe I'll go to Rome. Whenever I hear that song, I just think, I want to do that.
Yeah.
But since you can't really, hotel rooms don't really come with pianos very often.
No, not very often. So that's what started it. And that's part of the reason why I can't believe anybody wouldn't value a piano, because I just thought it would be so wonderful to have one.
Yeah.
And so when I see them being thrown out, I just can't understand how we've come to that point.
Well, my heart breaks for you retroactively for your younger self.
Yes.
Yeah, too bad we weren't buddies. You could have come over to my house and played ours.
I bet they wouldn't have, your mother would have said, get that woman, get that girl off the piano. She's driving us nuts. How much chopsticks can one person listen to, right?
She would have said, get that girl to start practicing her scales.
Yeah, that's true. I tried everything else. I tried clarinet and other instruments, but they weren't satisfying. I was, nobody wants to listen to you playing clarinet either, just for the record.
Maybe I'll go to Amsterdam, or maybe I'll go to Rome, and rent me a grand piano and put some flowers around my room. But let's not talk about fare-thee-wells now. The night is a starry dawn, and they're playing that scratchy rock and roll beneath the mantle moon. Come on, Carrie, get out your cane.
Put on some
seal.
You're
a mean old daddy, but I like you.
The way you're talking, I mean, if you sit down, you don't feel like you have to be great in order to get satisfaction
no.
and pleasure from it. So it doesn't have to, you don't have to sound like, you know, McCoy Tyner. You don't have to sound like Rubinstein in order to get great pleasure, because when you're sitting down, it's making sound. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It doesn't even really matter to me mm-hmm. if the piano's in tune in a way, right?
Well, I like the sour sound of a honky-tonk out-of-tune piano, actually. I like that sort of. But it also gives you such great feedback because you're surrounded by the sound.
Yeah.
Other instruments, like the clarinet, for example, that don't really do that for you because you don't really hear it.
Yeah.
Even guitar, playing guitar without any amplification, sort of the sound goes away from you. But the piano, it surrounds you.
Yeah, it's almost protecting you in mm-hmm. a way, I find. I loved what Alex Russell was saying on your podcast. He's a mutual friend of ours, and he was talking about the instant gratification of the piano, and
the fact that it's always out. When it's out, then you're encouraged to make music. You just have to walk by, and you know, just for even a few seconds, sit down, and suddenly you're making music.
Yeah.
And he made the point that humans have forgotten that mm-hmm. we can make music. Mm-hmm. We just receive music. We're passive receivers of it. And he has a piano so that he can actually make it again. And I think that's lovely.
In your podcast, you talk a lot about what materials went into making it. And we've obviously talked about the ebony and the ivory, which aren't, you know, used anymore, thankfully. But the Sitka spruce of the soundboard mm-hmm. and all the other wood that goes into it. And I think there's wrought iron is in there, right? And, you know, I guess that's what makes the sound of a piano so unique and appealing compared to, say, if you turn on your electric keyboard or if you... Mm-hmm.
Well, the vibration of the strings, and you can, if you have a, you know, if you're playing, lucky enough to play a grand piano, you can actually see the hammers. It's a dance. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the soundboard, I didn't realize till I did this research that the soundboard is so critical. And I didn't realize that many piano soundboards come from Canada, from the West Coast and Alaska, and that their Sitka spruce is a preferred wood uh-huh. and that in order to get the nice tight grain that makes the best sound, these trees have to be 100 years old or more. So that means that I said this in the piece, some of the pianos going into the dump were made from trees that were growing when Beethoven was composing.
Yeah, that is a crazy fact.
Because, you know, you have like 300 years there where it took 200 years for the tree to grow and another 100 years for the piano or more. Yeah, so I was like, really, does nobody want to save that? But mm-hmm. actually, nobody really can, apparently. I mean, put it this way, they could mm-hmm. if somebody suddenly started a let's save the piano movement. But the wood isn't that useful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really useful for soundboards anymore because of the tension. The piano is under constant tension, which I didn't realize.
Right.
And so over all those years of all that tension, the wood gets damaged
right.
in a way that you can't really use it for that purpose anymore. Some people try to make crafts out of it and that kind of thing, but it really is. There's really no large scale effort to reuse that wood.
Wow.
And then there's the cabinet wood. That's some beautiful old, you know, types of wood, but they're small pieces. So unless you happen to know a carpenter who's standing by ready to spend what would take many hours to take apart a piano, including the risky business of trying to, you know, cut the strings because the strings are under such tension. Mm. There's not much, and there's not much value even in the gigantic cast iron plate that holds it, that holds all the tension. It's not really worth anything either. So
really,
and that also makes it really heavy. So you can't.
Yeah.
People have tried to turn them into bookcases, and you heard Alex Russell say he tried to cut the top off, and he tried to turn it into a.
Kind of thing.
He's like, we finally had to give up on that, he said. So it was a nice try, but my conclusion was pianos aren't good for much else besides being pianos.
Right.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
Unless we could figure out how to salvage things.
As a journalist, you know, you've had access to a lot of interesting spaces that mm-hmm. the public normally doesn't get to go into.
Mm-hmm.
And for this piece, you were lucky enough to go into the Paul Hahn piano shop and see the workings behind the scenes, right? And speak to
Alex Hahn.
Alex Hahn.
Third generation Hahn working on pianos. Well, Alex is so lovely. I'm sure anybody could go in and ask to see the inner workings. But anyway, she was very sweet and took me all through this amazing place. Yeah. And yeah, it's fascinating. In the there's people working on the pianos, which is interesting in itself. You just see the exposed pianos and other, someone takes Mark DeCourt was another piano technician I talked to, and he pulled the guts of the piano. It's amazing. He actually was playing it. You could see the hammers dancing in the air. It's not making any sound, but you get a sense of the incredible kinetic energy that is going on to create the sound. Mm-hmm. But Alex, in the basement of her shop.
And that's just on Yonge Street.
Yeah.
Right?
It's been there forever. She has all these pianos waiting to be, some of them are pianos that are being repaired for customers, for clients. Mm-hmm. Others are ones that she's restoring, hoping to, she salvages. She's like, I called her a piano rescuer because she looks for the pianos that she can save, and she, does save them. Mm-hmm. So there's all these pianos lying on their side, these grand pianos with these, blue, protective cloths over them. They look like sort of whales. Mm-hmm. And as she's walking along, she says, oh, yeah, this is interesting. And she pulls a piece of paper down. This is Gordon Lightfoot's piano.
Wow.
And I'm going, what? I don't believe. And she goes, look, it's Gordon Lightfoot's piano. And sure enough, it was Gordon Lightfoot's piano he bought from Paul Hahn in 1974.
Oh, wow.
And this was a year or so ago. And he was asking Alex to find it a new home because he wanted to give it away to somebody.
Oh.
So she had found a music school that was going to take it because he just wanted it to be loved.
Absolutely.
But I thought, wow, that is pretty cool.
That
Gordon Lightfoot's piano.
Have you visited Glenn Gould's piano at Roy Thomson Hall?
Well, yeah, because I worked at the CBC.
Of course.
But we weren't, I never touched it.
Would you have been allowed?
No, the CBC used to keep a hat. There's events that happen all the time. So there are floating pianos around there, and every now and then there'll be this gorgeous piano in the atrium, and I'm just like, oh, come on, can't we touch it? But it's locked. It's off.
And that was one that he would have played. Or was it just
there was a few pianos in various studios too, so I don't know which piano was which. I just know that I saw beautiful pianos and I didn't touch them.
Fair enough. Recently purchased a new piano for your home. This is your third in this place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a Saga.
A Saga.
A piano Saga.
I thought you were telling me that was the type of piano, but I thought, no.
It's the story of the quest for the piano.
So you had one here, and then you weren't 100% happy with it.
It's your fault. It's your fault, Jane. Here's the story. So we had this old, it was called a Stark. It was made by a company in Chicago or something. Mm. And I thought it was great. It was just this old, big old grand piano that Paul purchased from a warehouse out by the airport 20 years ago. And he's been carrying it around ever since. It's been moved a million times. So, we thought, we have a piano. And you were looking for a place to do a house concert.
Right.
And so we have a piano and kind of an open sort of concept spot. So
yeah, this is a great place for a house concert, by the way.
So Jane comes over. We decided, Paul said, we better tune the piano up for this big event. So we called a piano tuner at random.
Let's give him a shout out.
Well, no, the first piano tuner we called at random, he gave up in disgust.
Really?
Yeah, he worked on it for about 10 or 15 minutes and said, it's these strings are dead. I can't do anything.
Oh.
And we went, so then you recommended Chris
Ritchie Conrad.
Chris came over and he tuned it, but in the nicest possible way said, because Paul was asking, should we, what do you think of this piano? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it's probably at the end of its life. And then you came over and played it, and there were, you found it, whatever you said was, Paul was like, oh no, we have to get a new piano. You said it was bright.
I think it was bright in places and then a little bit not so bright in other places. But it was fun. Like, we had a great concert.
Oh, yeah. It was, my naive ear, it sounded fine.
Yeah.
But this started Paul then on this quest because he's like, oh, and then he started to, you know, really think about, well, what does a good piano sound like? What would a piano sound like if we didn't? And so Chris, who works with Alex Hahn, suggested we go see her, that he could check out her shop. And so he found one that, he liked better, that was, you know, affordable. And so we brought that home. And now, by now, though, he's completely obsessed by the sound. So I think the new piano sounds fine. And he played it for a year. And then he said, well, I'm going to go back to Alex's shop and play every piano in the place. And so he played the one we have now, and he seems to like it. So I think we're good. I think we're good on the, I think we found the piano. But the best part for me was when we decided that the Stark couldn't be salvaged, that it was a chance now to see how hard it is to get rid of a piano, because we've been told that there was no value. There was really no point in trying to sell it. And I didn't want to sell it. I just wanted to give it to somebody who would enjoy it. But I thought, there's no chance, because there's free pianos lined up down the street. So I wrote up this ad, and I tried to make it sound enticing. I said, vintage piano, you know, made, you know, 100 years ago. And I said, most of the original parts, which in a piano is actually not a great thing, but it sounded good, right? And because I'm thinking, no one's going to even phone about this piano or respond.
Yeah.
And within about 45 minutes of putting this thing up, we had dozens of people. Mm-hmm. I think we oversold it. And the picture, it looked really nice in the picture. So we just took the ad down and told the first person who called that they could come and get it. And the person said he would come tomorrow. But I said, well, you're going to need a mover. He's like, oh, no, I got some friends. I watched a YouTube video. I think we can move it. I'm like, okay, if you can. So they came. And it was quite an adventure. Mm-hmm. Paul had to chip in, and I recorded the whole thing. So you can hear it on the program at the end. The piano's bouncing down the stairs. Bang,
now
bang.
It makes quite a sound when it's heading down those stairs. Yeah.
But it's great. This story has such a happy ending, because they loaded it on a truck, and drove it down the 401 in the wintertime. It wasn't covered or anything. It just, you know. Yeah. And a few hours later, we got a text, and they'd set the piano up, and it was in the kitchen, because it was a small house. But this person was so, you know, keen to get a piano, and I thought, it's great. So before I put the program together, I just checked in one last time to make sure that, you know, that it hadn't only been up there for a day, and I would be, you know, not telling the truth if I said this is how the story ended, but it's still there.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I just think it's such a great story. So I think it suggests that there's a way, you know, to share these instruments, and that people might actually, there may be a way, but we haven't made, there's just really no system or no, you know, sort of no method in place to me. Okay, another interesting thing is that everyone has the impulse, well, I'll give it to charity. The charities are saying, don't bring us any more free pianos, because they don't know what to do with them. They can't you know, they don't want them. Mm-hmm. They can't afford to tune them, they can't afford to move them.
So
the dilemma of the piano.
Well, I mean, I think if you are going to take one in, I think the kitchen is a great place, because most parties take place around the kitchen anyway.
Exactly.
So you've got your salon and your kitchen built right in there.
Well,
if you can fit it in your
kitchen. I don't see why you can't. I mean, why can't you have a piano? Like, why can't you use the piano as a table and also as a piano? I mean.
Exactly.
'Cause the piano has been drinking. The piano has been drinking, not me, not me, not me, not me, not me.
You obviously love the piano, but you're also going back to your collection tendencies. You have a guitar collection of sorts.
Sort of. I have what they call GAS, guitar acquisition syndrome.
Oh.
Guitar collectors joke about that. Yeah, I know.
But you play guitar.
Yeah, the same. Kind of like I play piano. I mean, I don't play for, I'm not a performer.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's really ever heard me play guitar.
I don't think I have, but you know, today might be the start of something beautiful, Kelly.
But it's the same thing. I just love playing it. I find it, I sort of totally self-taught. And yeah, so combining the love of playing it with my possession problem, then of course I started, you know, and I love things that are old, right? Mm. So there, I don't know if it's a fair bias, but it seems to me that things are better made or were better made. So I do have a few. I have a beautiful Gretsch Chet Atkins Country Gentleman that was made in 1977. Beautiful looking. Huh. It's very twangy. Yeah. So I have a beautiful little Martin acoustic that I bought for myself after the CBC went on strike, and we were all having a very miserable time. And when the strike was settled, they gave us a small strike sort of a settlement bonus.
Oh.
And I took that money and I bought myself a guitar because I wanted to, you know, have something good come out of that experience. So,
right.
Yeah, so I bought my little Martin.
That's
and
a good choice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I've learned the hard way, because people used to give me guitars for my birthday and stuff, that, and I never played them. And I used to think that was because I was just not that motivated. But I realized that it didn't feel good. Like the action is too high, or the guitar is too big, or, you know, it's too hard to play.
Yeah.
So I found out the hard way that you should get the guitar that you love right off the bat, even if you feel you're not a worthy player, because right. you'll play it if you love the way it feels and sounds.
Yeah.
You won't play it if it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine who was also a CBC employee who was also on strike, we went out and went to a used guitar shop, and he played it because it was too intimidated, and I liked the way it sounded and I liked the way it felt, so I bought it, and I've just been plucking away on that ever since. I have some other guitars I'd like to get, but I'm holding off. I'm making myself play every day till I earn the right to get another one.
What are those ones?
I'd love to get a vintage Telecaster.
Oh, okay.
In that refrigerator green color, blue color.
Okay.
And I'd
if
like to get.
If anyone has one in their basement that they're not using.
I'd love a resonator. I love that sound. And I'd love it to try a 12 string.
Yeah.
So those are on my list, my GAS list.
When you do play an instrument, and you're right, you should pick the one that makes that you like, that you feel good, no matter how much you're playing it. It doesn't have to be a fancy guitar. It can be.
Oh, no.
Any guitar,
in fact,
right?
And you're going to have to help me with the name of, what's the name of that wonderful guitar player who plays with Gillian Welsh?
David Rawlings?
Yeah, David Rawlings plays an old guitar that he found at a flea market or a friend's attic or
friend's
something?
Friend's attic, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it sounds incredible.
It's amazing. So, yeah, absolutely.
And I want to sing that rock and roll. I want to electrify my soul. Cause everybody been making a shout so big and loud, been drowning me out. I want to sing that rock and roll.
When you're thinking about music in general, because you're a music lover and someone who does play, I'm just wondering, when you hear music in your head, does it have an abstract form, or is it something that you're feeling yourself playing it kind of?
Yes, it's more concrete for me than abstract. I'm not a songwriter, so I don't have songs working their way. I wish I did. I think that would be wonderful. But I don't have, you know, a tune kind of worming its way through my brain. So I guess it's more action oriented. Like I like mm-hmm. the feel of it. I like the way, you know, the sort of the feedback you get from, you know, moving your hands on the strings and that sort of thing. And listening to music, I separate from, now that you're asking me, I realize mm-hmm. I don't think about the music that I hear other people playing having anything to do with the music that I play. Like my playing music is like, sort of like you might go out and toss around a football or something. It's that kind of, and when you go hear music, uh-huh. it's completely absorbing, incredibly, sort of, it's the right word. It you forget about everything else and just concentrate on the music. That's a whole other kind of music. And then the music right. you would hear on the radio or in the background, that I consider that sort of a third category of music. Yeah. I have never really, no one's ever asked me that before, but I think I'm a concrete versus an abstract
right.
music thinker.
And do you listen to music when you're working?
No, I don't. Mm. I like quiet because, and I realize why. Music messes with your mood. And I want to be in control of how I feel. So if a song comes on the radio that's one of those songs that, you know, is evocative for whatever reason, I just don't want the emotional trip. Mm. Some songs you hear, you just stop you cold. And it's like, oh. Uh-oh. And so for a while, when we first got our iPods, you know, and music became so portable suddenly, I used to walk to work and it took me about an hour to walk. So I would listen to music the entire time. Yeah. And that was great. But what happened was I was afraid that I was losing my hearing because in order to hear it over the traffic, I would turn it up and up and up.
Right.
So I stopped doing that. So what happens is, Paul, we've talked about, he's a huge music lover and mm-hmm. he likes to control his music. So he'll want to listen to this or he'll suddenly go into a prog rock thing or a metal thing and suddenly, or a industrial, and we're suddenly listening to this. And, you know, I just kind of go along with whatever he's playing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we do is we leave, this wonderful radio station called Radio Paradise on. And I love their musical taste matches mine pretty closely. So I just let them pick it.
Right.
So that's often on in the house. But if I'm alone, I don't have music on. I have it. It's quiet.
Can you think of some recent concerts and venues that have just sort of managed to sweep you away? You were talking just about mm-hmm. being absorbed by music, and it's just a totally different thing than, say, when you pick up the guitar.
Yeah.
But any great concerts or great places that you've watched music?
One thing that stopped me in my tracks was the Regina Spektor at Massey Hall. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, her original concert was canceled because of COVID. So we forgot that we even had those tickets. And then we got a notice that, oh, it's happening, you know, next week. So we went, and I had never heard her live. I mean, I heard her songs on Radio Paradise, and that's why we thought, oh, she's really, it sounds interesting. We should go hear her. But in person, she just blew me away. Wow. I mean, it was jaw dropping.
Really?
I had a mask on, but my jaw was dropped. Her songwriting is so inventive and intelligent, and she's got, and of course, her voice is lovely, and she was on stage with a gigantic grand piano that she apparently was traveling around with. It's her piano.
Oh wow!
She said she had this relationship with this piano, and yeah, so that was a stunning experience. Some of the greatest musical experiences are things that you come across randomly. Mm-hmm. For example, my sister and I were in Montreal when I was working on the piano piece, and we were just walking around and along the porch. You know, it was, the stars were out. It was a nice warm night. We'd hear this tinkling in the distance, and so we walked towards it. And we're on a boardwalk, and it's dark, and you can barely make out. In the distance, we saw there were these people sitting around. And as we got closer, we realized there's a piano sitting in the grass, middle of nowhere. People are sitting on rocks. And it was just such an enchanting moment. And this old is one of the ugliest pianos I've ever seen. Its keys were all black, and the wood was peeling off. But people were just playing it. And yeah, so that was really nice. And I think those are the times when you just come across mm-hmm. a performance that I think those are also really magical. I guess we'll get back into the swing of things once we start going out more. But we, you know, Tim, our friend Tim Faulkner is always dragging us around to hear bands we never heard of.
Well, I'm really glad he dragged us
yes.
together. Definitely. And so I'm really excited about your Possession project. And it's just such a cool thing. You're launching episode 3 soon?
Yes.
I mean, these things are big research projects. There's a lot of elements. You go out and
I take my time.
You do Zoom calls. You go out in the field.
Well, after more than 30 years of working on news deadlines, I am just enjoying just relaxing with it. It takes as long as it takes, because I don't think anyone's, I actually don't believe anyone's listening. It doesn't even matter if anyone listens. I mean, obviously I would like that. That would be great.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing it for that reason. I'm doing it because I'm just enjoying the process and I'm curious. So the one I'm working on right now is about letters. When you look at a pile of possessions that, you know, that people have, they invariably have a shoebox or even maybe a gigantic box full of documents, handwritten letters, cards, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about why we can't throw these out. Mm-hmm. And I'm also really interested in, people aren't writing letters anymore. So what will be what's being lost? You know, where will biographers and historians look to find out what our lives were like if we're not writing these letters? And also, we're not keeping our texts and emails in any kind of a electronic shoebox, right? We're just, technology's changing so fast, we can't even access. I mean, I've got floppy disks and notes on various computer technology that I'll never be able to retrieve. So I wanted to explore this idea of the letter, and it's been really interesting.
And you were able to talk to my friend Steve Wright,
yes,
who was my second guest in Music Buddy. And I know him to be an avid letter writer and a collector of all kinds of crazy instruments.
Yes.
And he also has a piano part, a big body of a piano just fastened to one of the walls in his studio.
I know. I needed to meet Steve. He has a lot. I think he might have to be a regular guest on my on my series. It's because of you, because one of your Music Buddy songs is his song.
That's right.
And I don't think the title is Write to Me, but the chorus is Write to Me, you know, Write Me a Letter. And I thought, why is somebody writing about writing letters? It just is fascinating. So
the title is Write to Me.
Oh, is it? Yeah, okay.
I think that's the title.
And yes. And oh, by the way, it has a great hook because I've been humming it. A lot.
I'll send you something really fun through the mail, all about my life and how it feels to sail. Write to me, I'll write you back.
Well, I'm looking forward to that episode, the letter writing episode coming out. It'll probably be already out by the time this airs, but who knows?
At the rate I'm going, it might not be.
If you wanted to go out, say, on a particular song, do you have a favorite song? One of your top three songs that you love of all time?
Holy Hannah.
Take your time.
My favorite song of all time.
Just any song that you love that pops into your head.
Yeah. Okay, I know one.
Don't
I
worry do, about no, what people think.
I have one. Here they are.
Okay.
Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, one of my all-time favorite songs. A song when I was a kid that I loved so much was that Burt Bacharach song, Raindrops Are Falling on My Head.
Oh, yeah.
I used to sing that all the time when I was a kid. I do love some performances. So if we put Joe Cocker's Woodstock performance, the song was I Get By With a Little Help From My Friends. I mean, I can't believe that performance is so amazing. And it's, you know, so I love that. You know, I love the Allman Brothers. I love sort of raunchy blues playing. I love wild blues guitar playing. Oh, I don't know.
Nice.
I can't pick one, Jane. I can't
That's
pick
That's pretty
a song.
Good, though.
I like gritty blues. I love indie rock. Yeah, there's lots.
Well, thank you for
talking,
taking the time.
It's fun.
And good luck.
Thank you.
With the Possession Project. Onwards and upwards.
Yes. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Will you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Oh baby, how you back?
Now, here's Kelly Crowe with an intimate at-home sampling of her piano improvisations, played on her and her partner Paul's 1924 Mason and Hamlin Baby Grand. Take it away, Kelly.
Okay. Hi, Jane. Okay. So, you asked me to give you a demonstration of what I do in front of the piano. So, this is it. And with apologies to all actual piano players. I just sit down and I just look for something that sounds nice to my ear. So this is something the other day I just sat down and I thought, that sounded nice. I tried to figure out where I could go from there. Half an hour, it's more like, it's not like piano playing as much as just sort of musical meditation. My timing is all wrong. I'm not disciplined enough to actually sit down and sort of, you know, read music and play something for real. But this is, no one ever hears this. This is just something I do, and it gives me enormous pleasure. So I'll give you a demonstration. This for hours.
Thanks for listening. Music Buddy is brought to you by Morning Run Productions. We get by with a little help from our friends, i.e., all of you. I'll be back in a couple of weeks or so with another episode. But in the meantime, if you're out in a park or on a street and you see a piano just sitting there, maybe consider giving it a home, taking it back to your kitchen, and throwing a party.